Hello, patrons, and welcome to the 45th annual patron special for Trek About the Show.
It's actually the 47th annual patron special.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Did we do that time travel a couple years ago?
I don't remember that. I think the events were, you know, erased from the timeline.
Well, that would be good. I hope that we could have that happen with Donald Trump as well.
Oh, yes, but maybe it will.
So, as promised, we are doing a patron special on the documentary, or as Richard likes to call it, Spockumentary.
Yes.
On For the Love of Spock.
Did they call it a Spockumentary at all?
I don't think so.
Because this is a big missed opportunity.
Well, fun fact, the PR firm or person or whoever that was in charge of doing the PR advertising for the Love of Spock back when it came out in, I believe, September of 2016, 2 months before the election and the end of all that is loving about America, contacted us actually to do some press, an interview specifically with Adam Nimoy, Leonard Nimoy's son, who directed this documentary, produced and directed this documentary. And we said, yes, we would love to interview Adam Nimoy because why would we say no? And it never happened because they never got back to us.
Because the timeline was erased.
Charitably speaking, I think that sometimes PR does not do the best job. But anyway, irregardless of that, we are doing this patron special on For the Love of Spock instead of pushing it out to everybody because we only want, like, we don't want our whole listenership to listen to hear this because we're being vindictive by the PR person who did not get back to us.
Yes.
So, no, I'm kidding.
They're not going to be our PR people.
So, I saw this documentary back in September in a theater. And I really liked it. It's maybe a bit too long, which we'll talk about. Hmm. But
well, I actually watched it in two sections, so it didn't feel too long to me. It felt like two episodes of a thing.
But I think watching it in two sections perhaps indicates that it is too long.
Maybe. I have about 45 minutes of attention span. That's really it.
You should probably work on that.
No.
There are exercises you can do.
I don't like exercising.
So this documentary started out, as I understand it, as Adam Nimoy says in the documentary, about really Spock specifically. And he approached his father to work on this documentary.
Yeah, it was the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, so it was supposed to be.
Right. And so, of course, then, sadly enough, Leonard Nimoy died in 2015, and the documentary then became also about the life of Leonard Nimoy as well as Spock, which is part of the reason why it is so long. And I do say, it's only about an hour and 40 minutes. It's not terribly long. It's very entertaining. I think that you know, I knew a lot of the stuff in the documentary already, although I didn't know a couple of things which surprised me, which we'll talk about at some point. But I think that, you know, for me, it was a very moving tribute to someone who was a lot more loved by the general public than perhaps anyone thought, if that makes sense.
I think, yeah. Yeah, it was very surprising how much love and tribute there was when Nimoy did die, and just how everybody seemed to be, you know, shocked a little by that. You know, obviously Trekkies, yeah, we're going to be devastated by it, but Spock is a part of American and the world iconography, really. It's something that a lot of people know, this character, and I think what I get from this movie is how complicated of a person Nimoy was, because certainly they focus on he was so loving, he was great to work with, he was very nice and benevolent, but then also the family stuff, he was kind of cold, he could be distant, he had certain demons that he was dealing with, and the coexistence of, again, this great love and this inability to connect.
Yeah. Because, I mean, one of the things that is so striking to me about the documentary is that I wouldn't say that it pulls punches about Leonard Nimoy's, you know, faults, and certainly everybody has them.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I didn't really know, actually, was that he had a drinking problem for a long time. And the documentary doesn't go into it a lot. I don't think that it's not something that it's not something that I don't think either of his children are that interested in talking about, frankly. And it's, you know, not to get too personal, but, you know, and I'm not going to talk about this for a long time, but, you know, I am the child of an alcoholic as well. So I know there are certain sort of things that happen in those types of families that don't get talked about. And so I don't think it's perhaps that surprising that Leonard Nimoy's children also don't really know how to talk about it, because that is kind of the thing about having an alcoholic in the family, is that everyone has this secret. No one ever talks about it. And it didn't really seem like Leonard Nimoy was an abusive alcoholic.
Yeah.
He just sort of shut down emotionally. That is also a form of emotional abuse, of course, but...
But a very different one than... in other words, if Nimoy had been a very loud, angry, violent drunk, there would be... I think that's kind of easier to talk about. It's very obvious to see why that was bad, how that affected them. Yeah, my dad would get drunk and hit me, you know. Everyone can understand that, but... My dad just drank and was just kind of distant at a point where he was not quite method acting, but they do go into how if you're acting as Spock 10 hours a day, it's going to naturally make you a little more emotionally closed off. And again, a form of abuse, maybe not quite abuse, maybe a little, but a weird situation, a difficult to delineates kind of situation, I would say.
Yeah, I think so. And that's one of the things that the documentary really, it does go into the character of Spock, goes into his conception, how Leonard Nimoy sort of approached him, where he found the character, where the character found him, where the character went over the years and things like that. But it does, I think, definitely intersperse that story with the story of Leonard Nimoy, placing both at the same time place, right? Like, you know, they talk about Leonard Nimoy, what he was doing before he got the role of Spock. You know, he was basically grew up in Boston, you know, Jewish kid. He was working in Hollywood as a bit player, a day player, movies and television, just kind of doing all this stuff. And, you know, Star Trek was the first series that he was a regular on. And that, of course, only lasted as long as it lasted, 3 years. And then it sort of intersperses it with, okay, well, what was he doing at that time? You know, talking about him getting married in the 50s, having these kids. I mean, his kids were like 10 years old at the time Star Trek was on. So one of the things that I think the documentary does really well is it shows, you know, Leonard Nimoy's feeling very responsible financially for his family.
Yeah.
And, you know, going out and doing all of these events, press events, appearances, paid to make as much money as possible to really ride this gravy train as long as he could.
Yeah, there is this very almost there is a very sense of child of depression kind of a thing. In other words, he went before he gets the role of Spock, before his career really takes off, he's again working as a day player, but also it's talking about how he's working these other jobs. He had a vending machine business, that he had all of this, this stuff in his house. So he's when Star Trek is on, I think he uses the phrase making hay while the sun shines kind of a thing. It's interesting during that bit, you realize that Nimoy would have had a reality series if that would have been a thing at the time.
Because
they're talking about how, you know, the family was in all of these magazine spreads and stuff like that. People were very interested. Nimoy is realizing this is only going to last so long. And as we know, Star Trek only lasted 3 years, and it was another decade or so before the movies and the fandom and all of that really kicked in. And so, you have these contradictory impulses, the one to say, all right, we're not going to be able, this isn't going to last forever. Let me, you know, if I'm working my ass off for 3-5 years and I'm not, whatever, as long as I'm getting what I can, when this ends, I'll go back to normal life. But also the understanding that this is his normal life at this point, and that this is doing some damage to his family. I mean, it's not talked about very much, but Adam talks about how he, you know, had been into drugs and had gotten into trouble as a teenager and older, and there is certainly the movie kind of elides that, but there is I can definitely see a connection between distant workaholic father and acting out and doing drugs kind of a thing.
Yeah, I definitely see that. I mean,
there is obviously a family predilection towards addiction in there.
Yeah, and there usually is. I mean, I think it's interesting because, I mean, there's one part of the documentary, not to be too churlish about the criticism, but you know, some of it does veer on the edge of sort of too self-referential to me, or I don't know, too self-serving. I don't I mean, not to be like terrible about it, but I don't know that I really care that much about Adam Nimoy. Like,
it's, and that's fair, because who is he beyond?
Right. And so I think that the weakest parts of the documentary are when he is talking about his own struggles. Mm. Only because, again, I don't know that he did a really good job contextualizing why the audience that is watching this documentary about Leonard Nimoy and Spock would necessarily care about the fact that, you know, he and his father had a strained relationship.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that definitely does color, you know, how we view Leonard Nimoy, right?
Yeah.
And I think that what I come away with, of course, is that Leonard Nimoy was a very hard worker. He was someone who was a man of great, but at the same time, a man of great integrity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a couple stories in the documentary that I had known about that were very moving, especially the one that George Takei tells about the animated series.
Yeah.
But you know, I look at this and I say, okay, there's this parts of the documentary that do work for me about Adam Nimoy are when he's looking at those letters that his father wrote to him and kind of giving the context for how Leonard Nimoy approached his own parental philosophy and being a father.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that a lot of men struggle with, obviously, who grew up with fathers that were not perhaps the best or felt like they were lacking or did not have a good relationship with their fathers. And to me, you know, what I see with Leonard Nimoy is a man who had a very emotionally distant father who realized that, but fell into the trap of also being emotionally distant because he was so busy trying to financially provide for his family.
And there, one of the things they talk about a couple times is he feels that, you know, Adam Nimoy says at one point he felt he was competing with his fans. I mean, he's out with his dad, they're on vacation or something, and all these fans are coming up, and you know, Leonard Nimoy feels that, oh yeah, well, they're my fans. I have to do right by them. I've got to at least say hello and take the photo, give them the autograph or whatever. And on the one hand, yes, as an actor, we love to see actors and musicians and people who will do anything for their fans, who care about the people, who are giving back to the people who have loved them. So, and that's a good thing. But when you realize he has to make the choice between his family and his career, and we can't necessarily, it's both. You can't necessarily blame him for doing right by his career because he knows that's supporting his family. And yet there is a line that gets crossed at one point without anybody even realizing it.
Yeah, because it's almost as though, it's funny, like I don't remember when those letters were dated, but I think they were written in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I think that's instructive because to me it indicates that Leonard Nimoy did some work on himself and realized that he was falling into the same trap of feeling like financially providing for his family was enough and not being there emotionally for his children was not important if he was financially providing for them. And that's obviously not true. I think that, you know, people need their parents around, not just financially. And so I think that was him realizing that maybe he didn't have to work quite so hard. Now, of course, some of that is also hindsight because Leonard Nimoy did not realize exactly the 50-year gravy train that Star Trek would become.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I think that he did mention in the 70s was when his career was so kind of in a slump again before, you know, post Star Trek, post Mission Impossible, pre Star Trek movies.
I mean, he was working.
Yeah.
I mean, he did Mission Impossible for 2 or 3 years, so that's not nothing.
But he's also talking about how unfulfilling that became very quickly.
Oh yeah, but I just mean in terms of the money he was making. He was another series regular, so that's good money for him. And then also he was doing that documentary series that they talked about, which I've actually never seen because it's before my time.
Okay.
The one, Mysteries of the World or something.
Okay.
Whichever that one is. Well, they showed a clip of it.
But I mean,
but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So they showed a clip of that, and Simon Pegg talks about seeing that as a kid, Mysteries of the Universe or something. I forget what it is. Kind of one of those like talking head documentaries, kind of like Unsolved Mysteries or something, only about the supernatural.
Okay.
He was in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which was a big deal.
So then he did theater stuff,
which
seemed to be the real, that was where he was really, as an artist, able to kind of sink his teeth the most.
Yeah. And so if you look at it and you say, okay, well, he was maybe creatively satisfied when he was playing Spock on Star Trek and then maybe Mission Impossible in his career, while financially he was doing well as an actor, maybe he was not that artistically or emotionally satisfied as an actor. when he was doing Mission Impossible, when he was doing that documentary series, that kind of stuff. And that seems to be the time period when he was sort of reevaluating what he felt was important and sort of like reaching out to his children again.
And there is, of course, the long shadow of Spock. I mean, his first biography, he called it I Am Not Spock, right? And then later he wrote the book I Am Spock. You know, that kind of, that ambivalence of that relationship with this character who made his fame, who made his career, and yet, number one, took so much in terms of family and, you know, emotional stuff, and also, again, casts the shadow over everything else. That was a character that he played till very shortly before he died, right?
Yeah. And I think that it's funny because to me, that's something that a lot of the original Star Trek actors went through, you know. William Shatner famously went through this. I think a lot of them went through this, where Star Trek essentially invented modern fandom.
Yeah.
And that's not a, I don't think that's an exaggeration. I mean, they pioneered the fan convention.
Yeah.
They pioneered the ways in which fans interact with their object of affection. I mean, slash fiction, which the documentary talks about a little bit, the convention thing, which the documentary talks about a little bit, the letter writing campaign that saved Star Trek, which the documentary does not talk about, which is very famous. You know, all of these things are sort of standard vehicles for fans now to interact with, you know, the actors and creators and the object of their fandom. But that was not something that really existed before Star Trek, and Star Trek fans created all of this.
Yeah.
So when they were making Star Trek, none of that existed. And so, okay, well, the show got canceled. All right, that's it. Like, we're never going to talk about this again. We're never going to see this again. You know, yeah, there were reruns, but it's not like people could buy DVDs of the show. It's not like there was YouTube. You know, none of this existed. And so it was an entirely different media landscape. And I think that attitude of, you know, I am not Spock, you know, I am not Kirk, you know, I don't want to be defined by this, was kind of a weird response to the growing fan culture that was putting them in boxes that they weren't used to. Nowadays, I think a lot of actors don't really have any sort of like hang-ups about that because they understand that that's just a part of who they are as actors, and it's not something that will define them, whereas the Star Trek actors, in a sense, were the like guinea pigs of that.
Yeah. I think there is a worry that one can't get beyond that. I mean, there's part of the reason it seems that he wanted to do Mission Impossible after Star Trek was, number one, how different of a show it was.
Yeah.
Going from science fiction to spy drama is very different types of shows. And also, this particular character being the master of disguise and getting all of these different roles that he could play. Again, Nimoy started off as a character.
All of these different racially insensitive.
Well, yeah, it was hilarious, you know. And then he was like, then I played the Indian and I played the Chinese man. And it's just like, oh. And then he talks about how, you know, then I did those five roles over again and over again. And you could see that getting very tired.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nowhere near as nuanced of a character as Spock goes. And we talk a lot about on the main podcast about Vulcans and Vulcans as emotional, but they're using the lot, not repressing the emotions. I don't think repressing is the right way, but, you know, a certain detachment. I haven't seen the Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake in a long time. Actually, the movie scared the fuck out of me when I saw it, but it's interesting watching the clip from that where he's talking, because that Spock is an emotionless character. Like, that clip alone highlights just the depth of how much is going on in Spock.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously the character who is taken over by the pod people has no emotions whatsoever.
Right. Yeah. No, I actually think that's a really good point. And I kind of thought the same thing as I watched that clip in the documentary as well, because, you know, like we talked about last month with Vulcans, you know, a lot of actors don't know how to play them and play them with a sort of flat affect. They're sort of like these emotionless robots, and that's not what Vulcans are. And I think that you're right that, you know, Leonard Nimoy is a very good actor.
Yeah.
I think that you could probably not say that about a lot of the actors on the original series. To be charitable, I think that there is a reason why a lot of them didn't have a long acting career afterward. I mean, certainly like people like DeForest Kelley and William Shatner and stuff obviously had acting careers before and after, but for the most part, you know, they're not the great thespians of our time.
Nichelle Nichols hasn't done, you know, a ton else. Walter Koenig's done some more character work, but I'm really only I know of him from Babylon 5, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Which is like an aside, but so Alexander Siddig just got cast as some character in, I don't know anything about Batman, in the TV show Gotham.
Okay.
And I was like, he must have a really good agent now, because he was in Game of Thrones in a really high-profile part in a really high-profile show for a while. Okay, he must be getting back into acting again. And then I went to his IMDb page, and he basically has been working consistently since Deep Space Nine went off the air, and I was like...
Interesting.
Huh. I mean, a lot of like bits parts, and
so
and,
maybe it was a case of just happened to get the Game of Thrones role. Maybe you know, whoever was casting loved DS9, you know, even something as simple as that. And you know, now Gotham is a part of that.
Yeah, but it's almost as though like, because Star Trek always has this reputation as a career killer, and I don't think that's true. I just think that sometimes actors get cast on Star Trek for reasons that don't have much to do with their acting ability, and. They don't act much after Star Trek, because Star Trek is something that, you know, before Enterprise got canceled, it was pretty much guaranteed to go seven seasons, and just the way it went.
And guaranteed to go seven seasons, and then you become, I mean, one of the things we in the documentary Trekkies that we watched, where they, several of the actors were talking about, you know, I didn't quite know what I was getting into when I, you know, joined the cast, but you're becoming part of a family, a part of a huge thing. I mean, you're a Star Trek actor. You're guaranteed to, if you show up at a convention, get a ton of people flipping out at how excited they are to see you.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
No matter how tiny of a role you play. So
I think that there was a I think this was about Star Trek Voyager. I think one of the cast members of Star Trek Voyager said this, where when they first got cast on the show and they went on set at the studio to start work, they already had a bunch of mail from Star Trek fans that were like, welcome to the family.
Oh.
And I think that's really true. Yeah. And I think that part of why that attitude persists, obviously, is because of the type of person that really likes Star Trek and is attracted to Star Trek, but also because of the love and respect that the actors from the original series gave back to the fans, I think embodied by Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, Star Trek fans are devoted and loving and maybe a little too rabid, but because the show has inspired that in them. It's true.
Yeah, and I, you know, if you look at convention clips from Leonard Nimoy, he was very good on stage. They have a couple of clips in the documentary when he was on stage at conventions.
Oh, the bit where he's reading the review of the first episode, like, that was hilarious. Like, you know, he's just, you know...
And I think that's, you know, Leonard Nimoy was a very, very complicated man, but he was very charming and he was very funny. And
which is gives part to the complexity. That's
And I think that it seems like one of the ways that I think the documentary works really well is it's able to contextualize Spock by looking at where Leonard Nimoy was in his life. It's able to contextualize Leonard Nimoy through the character of Spock. And it's almost as though the character of Spock is there. Obviously it's broader than Leonard Nimoy at this point because Zachary Quinto plays him not very well, in my opinion, but that's a side issue.
I don't think of Zachary Quinto as one of the great actors of our time, and I've seen him in a couple other things. So
but it contextualizes it as well through these talking head interviews with celebrities about Spock and their relationship with Spock. I mean, you know, they talk to J.J. Abrams, and they, you know, Adam Nimoy talks to Simon Pegg. He talks to his uncle and aunt, right? He talks to J.J. Abrams?
I think so.
He talks to Zachary Quinto. He talks to Jason Alexander. So he's talking to a lot of people, and he's sort of asking them about Leonard Nimoy, the person. But then also, obviously, Jason Alexander did not know Leonard Nimoy. Maybe he met him once or twice, but he didn't know him as a person. So you get these very different sides of the person from these interviews.
Yeah.
That it's kind of like, you know, you look at someone like his brother and his sister-in-law, for example, and, you know, they knew the man. They were very supportive of him. And they loved him. You know, they said that they would go to all of his theater openings. East of the Mississippi.
their impressions of when they went to the convention to see, like, how funny that was.
Yeah. Right, right. Like, what the hell's going on here? But then you have someone like Jason Alexander who obviously loves Star Trek a lot and is able, he recites that whole Kirk speech. And
didn't know that. And another side, I didn't know Jason Alexander was that much of a nerd.
I guess it's not that surprising.
But yeah, it makes sense, but you know.
But you do get those different sides of the person, because I think that, you know, Spock obviously is very, he's a character that has really become larger than Leonard Nimoy, larger than Star Trek. I mean, everybody knows who he is. And Leonard Nimoy has by extension also become kind of that person.
Yeah, because obviously you usually don't see one without the other. And I really like that they go into the more of the creative choices, you know, how that reading of the line fascinating was kind of what one of the big parts that clicked the character in, that he's going to have that particular reaction to something. And you almost see this, I mean, we're, you know, talking about how his relationship with his own father, as, you know, reflecting in his relationship with his son. I mean, there is almost that old school, well, the purpose of, you know, the job of the father is to provide. He isn't necessarily going to be the nurturing one, but, and again, Nimoy did a very good job of providing for his family. He did work his ass off. He did, you know, whatever he could. As far as his impressions of his job was, he thought he was doing a good job, you know. And, you know, just as Spock doesn't necessarily deal with the emotional effusive side and yet still has those. There are, and they talk about the moments in which, for example, the end of Amok Time when he, you know, excitedly screams out Jim, you know, or even in, you know, again, moments where the emotions of Spock overtake him. And certainly there were moments when the desire of Leonard Nimoy to connect with his family overtook him, and he did, you know, make his efforts, and he wasn't necessarily always successful at that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he made his mistakes, but I think at the end, of all the, you know, I keep thinking of that line at the end of Wrath of Khan, you know, of all the souls I know, he was the most human. I mean, take human to mean flawed but well-meaning, and that's Leonard Nimoy too.
I think so. I mean, I that's why I like the documentary so much.
Yeah.
It does not elide the parts of Leonard Nimoy's personality or personal story that perhaps not as complimentary to Leonard Nimoy, because of course we all have those parts of ourselves.
And he was a man. He wasn't larger than life. He wasn't a character. Right.
He was a person.
And the document. Yeah, I was worried that the documentary would be too lionizing, too. Yeah, but
and maybe that's part of the personal story there, the personal angle, that a documentary like this made by someone who was not his son.
Yeah,
you know, they might not have felt comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, dishing out the dirt. You know, I wonder about that. I mean, I think that you know, certainly, again, I think there are a couple parts of the documentary that veer a little too into the, like, you know, what was me, Adam Nimoy stuff. Yeah. But it is part of the story, and I think it's a very good way to contextualize that, and it's a way to feel comfortable with telling it. And also, frankly, too, that you know, he was working with Leonard Nimoy on this documentary before he died, and so the documentary has his imprimatur. And I don't know where some of the I'm assuming that some of the narration that is done by Leonard Nimoy in the documentary was recorded before his death, specifically for this documentary.
No, it was recorded after his death.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Leonard Nimoy's Katra has come back.
Remember.
But seriously though, I mean, like, you know, that to me indicates that Leonard Nimoy at least had some kind of idea about what this documentary was going to be like.
Yeah, you know, maybe Adam did say, you know, I'd like to talk about what it was like to grow up, or, you know, how you know, maybe your early days and how you were working all that. Yeah, I'm sure there was, you know, you don't get the sense that any of this would have been a surprise or that he was revealing anything from behind his back or anything.
Because I think a perfect example of that is when Leonard Nimoy recounts the story where he came up with the Vulcan salute from.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, it's something that I had sort of known, but not, you know, sort of not really the full extent of it. But apparently, you know, essentially that is a hand gesture that Jewish men, I guess, use in ceremonies. And
it's a very, and it's a one with fairly mystical overtones. Yeah. It's the first letter in the ineffable name of God. So,
which is always something that has struck me that Vulcans are kind of like space Jews in a sense. So, but I think that that's also something which that comes from Leonard. Yeah. Nimoy.
Again, he, you know, I like particularly that story. It's something that he's not quite supposed to say. You know, he is told, you know, oh, cover your face, you know, out of reverence, out of respect. Yeah. But he's saying, oh, what's the secret? And frankly, with the Vulcan salute, he gives that secret, you know, to the world. That's kind of interesting. But
yeah, I think so. Now, something I just thought of that I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on is, you know, we've talked about the documentary in terms of, you know, speaking to Leonard Nimoy's, both his contentious relationship with his own father and his contentious relationship with his son and his daughter. I wonder if you think that his approach in handling the material in Journey to Babel was influenced at all by his own relationship with his father.
Because
it strikes me as very strange that the character of Spock is estranged from his own father and that his father is so emotionally distant.
Yeah, I mean, it could be very as simple as, you know, he and DC Fontana had a very long conversation about their childhoods over drinks one day, and, you know, that's where because she wrote that episode, correct? Yeah. That's where that particularly came from. But, and that, yeah, it makes that episode even more resonant in that way, given that, you know, given that Spock seems to be closer, that his mother is a little more doting. And again, Nimoy's mother was the stay-at-home mom. And interesting, she had been an actress herself who gave up the career to be the housewife.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. A question that I have, and it's not a major one, but I didn't understand any of the Big Bang Theory stuff. Now, I really fucking hate that show, and I hate so much about that show. I find it very odious, and I find, you know, it's one of, it reminds me of, you know, people who are not nerds watch it, you know, to make fun of nerds, kind of a thing. But so, was that the actor, was that in character, where they did they do the interview on, like, I didn't understand any of that.
Well, so speaking as someone who watched every episode of The Big Bang Theory until this year, and then I realized that there were like four episodes sitting on my DVR to watch, and I said, you know what, I'm just going to stop watching this. It was more, I never really liked the show. It was more just a habit, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. It's fine to have a show that you just watch as a show to have in the background to catch up with. Yeah.
That was pretty much it. The Big Bang Theory, to me, as I understand it, they have a respect for, I don't know. It's complicated. I don't know that Chuck Lorre is a nerd.
Yeah.
I don't think that this is coming from him. I think that his co-writer and co-producer, who was interviewed for the documentary, is a big nerd. I think they go out of their way to be very accurate in the types of things that they would talk about. And I think that if the show itself comes across a little bit like a nerd, I don't even want to say minstrel show, but it's almost like a...
It's okay. You know how, like, you look in the Think Geek catalog and it has all this stuff that's the accoutrements of nerddom, and, you know, you'll order everything and then you can be a proper nerd. Like, its nerdiness is a costume and an accessory checklist, is my impression of...
I mean, I don't know when to go down a big tangent of talking about nerd culture, but
especially because we probably have a lot of fans of the show listening that I just offended, and I'm sorry.
I'll put it to you this way. The Think Geek stuff, I think that is a company for nerds by nerds that love this stuff, and I have a lot of Think Geek stuff, you know, so. But
we all do.
but right, that's my point. And then also, like,
well,
I just think that in general, most people don't have a good or well-developed sense of humor. And nerds are a subset of the larger population. Yeah. And so a lot of nerds are also not going to have a good or well-developed sense of humor. And I think that's where that's coming from.
Well, no, I guess my question is, are they, when they have a person that they are interviewing on the set of The Big Bang Theory, I couldn't tell if they were interviewing Sheldon Cooper in character or him out of character.
Oh, no, that was the actor.
Okay, because it seemed like there were parts, though, when, you know,
So there was an episode. I've seen almost every episode of The Big Bang Theory, and I cannot tell you to name a plot from a single episode. That's how forgettable the show is to me.
He gets a bird in one episode. That's the one I saw.
Sure. I have no recollection of that whatsoever, but that's certainly true. That I think there was an episode of the show that Adam Nimoy was on that was interviewing the characters for this documentary. So there is a section of that where it's like it's fake shot from the point of view of the camera with the frame and stuff. That was the character, Sheldon Cooper.
Okay, so they had Adam Nimoy to promote the upcoming documentary, assume it maybe even when Nimoy was still alive, appeared as a guest on The Big Bang Theory, and they showed that clip. And then later they interview the actor who played. Okay. That part was genuinely confusing to me, and it's because I didn't watch that episode or whatever. But
yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, I think that's a fair criticism of the documentary that part was confusing. You know, I'm not saying this is a perfect documentary.
No, and whatever. That said, you know, when interviewing the you know, as you said, does this come from Chuck Lorre? Probably not, but from the actor who plays Sheldon, and I don't know his name, and from Maya and Bialik, the two of them talking about their love for Star Trek and such does come off very genuinely. And certainly that is going to appear in the show, and that probably is, you know, maybe why they wanted to play these characters or something.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
And I do, you know, did very much appreciate, you know, they had a bunch of scientists on, you know, and they're like, oh, yeah, I loved watching Spock, and that's why I decided to do this.
Favorite Twitter asshole, Neil deGrasse Tyson, was in the documentary.
Oh, he tries.
Let's talk about someone who does not have a good or well-developed sense of humor. It's Neil deGrasse Tyson. But anyway.
It's like, I can't quite hate Neil deGrasse Tyson, but
he's just someone who thinks he's a lot funnier than he actually is. So, you know, stop trying out your open mic material on Twitter and go back and do some astrophysics, Neil deGrasse Tyson, because you're not very funny.
You've seen photos of young Neil deGrasse Tyson, though, right?
I don't think so.
Oh, wow. So he was a very comely lad as a young man. I read a story that he was going to be like a Chippendale or something, or like a strip dancer. And I was like, really? And then I showed a photo and I'm like, oh, okay.
So was Joseph Stalin, actually.
Huh.
Not comparing Neil deGrasse Tyson to Joseph Stalin. Just
but they
make
both
that
have
clear.
Mustaches. Ooh. And you've never seen them in the same room together.
So I think the other part of it as well is that the documentary does a really good job of really giving a sense of the breadth of Leonard Nimoy's entire career.
Yeah.
You know, as we talked about his acting stuff in the 50s and then Star Trek and Mission Impossible and what he was doing in the 70s. And then it transitioned over to, okay, well, now we're making these Star Trek movies. And how are we going to get Leonard Nimoy? And he had a lot of power and all this kind of stuff. And then his directing career, which was kind of short-lived, sadly. But, you know, he did legitimately direct the best Star Trek movie, Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home.
Yeah.
I will fight anyone who does not like that movie. I think the people that don't like that movie are no fun at parties. And and also Three Men and a Baby.
Which I really didn't know.
Yeah.
I had forgot. I knew that he directed Star Trek III. I had forgotten he directed Voyage Home. And it was interesting to note how much of, in a way, a passion project that was. That was, in a way, Nimoy's vision of what Star Trek is. And I liked how he said, you know, yeah, it's who was it that was saying, you know, yeah, we went to his house for a read through of the script and he was playing the whale songs. And that's when we realized like how much this meant to him.
Yeah,
and that was very, that particular movie and the themes of that particular movie, given that that turned out to be so personal, gives a very sharp insight into who he was and what he thought was important to say. You know, this was the first, you know, he said Star Trek III, he felt very reined in. And then when it was time before, they said, okay, you know, you've proven you can direct this, you know, do what you want. And
well, that's, yeah, I think that's right. Cause one of the, those oral histories that I like to talk about on Trek About that I have now finished reading. Sadly, there, I need another volume of them, but maybe we'll get one when Star Trek Discovery comes out. Is that Leonard Nimoy was really, really passionate about Star Trek and really wanted to make it very good. And that's why he wasn't going to come back for the motion picture originally, because he didn't think it was a very good script, which he actually says in this documentary. And it wasn't, to be clear.
Yeah.
But
it gave a very when he's saying like, oh, this was effects Star Trek. Yeah, that was a very clear that was more succinct than probably our podcast on why it was bad.
Well, it's true. Yeah, it's true, because I think that one of the things that is less known or less admired or about Leonard Nimoy is that he had a very well-developed aesthetic sense, mm-hmm. and that. You know, again, one of the things about the oral histories is that they, you know, Nicholas Meyer and other writers would talk about Leonard Nimoy was very involved in developing the scripts and the stories for the Star Trek movies that he was involved in. And he usually made them a lot better. He was able to get to the core of why it was working or why it wasn't working. And, you know, Star Trek IV is a really good example of that because, you know, again, it's my favorite Star Trek movie. It's the best Star Trek movie. And I will not have any criticism of it. And what it comes down to for me is you look at that movie and you say, okay, this is a very different Star Trek movie than any of the other ones that have been made before. It's very human. It's very funny.
Yeah.
It's also very optimistic about the future. It has this environmental message. You know, there's a lot of nice, real stuff in there, meaty stuff that is very Leonard Nimoy and is very different from all the other Star Trek movies. And it's certainly different from like William Shatner's Star Trek V, for example. Yeah.
If that was Shatner's personal vision of what Star Trek was, that's kind of sad almost.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go down a road of criticizing William Shatner because that's not really the topic of this podcast, but
and
I don't think that William Shatner is as good a director or writer as Leonard Nimoy is.
Well, you can. I think in four, the comedy serves the story as the underpinning. They get some mileage out of the anachronisms and stuff, but at the core of the story is the environmentalism message, is the view of Starfleet as trying to protect and fix what, you know, the world and the problems there of the threats to home, of all of those things. Star Trek V has some vagueness about the search for God, but I think was intended to be more of a... I mean, the comedy is broader in that. I think just maybe Shatner just has a broader comedic sense, isn't as... It doesn't have as nuanced a set of comedy as...
Well, I don't agree with that, because a lot of the comedy in there was forced on him by Paramount. Okay. So, yeah.
Interesting. Well, I mean, that's... Maybe that was Shatner's, you know... You've got to direct the movie very much under the thing, but if he had directed six, he would have had more of a longer leash. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know.
Either way, five wasn't as well done as three even was, so.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've kind of said all we can say about the documentary. I think it's worth watching. It's on Netflix, at least in the United States. So if you live in the United States or an associated territory, you should definitely check it out.
Yeah.
And, it's good. I like it. I mean, I think that I'm really excited for Adam Nimoy is involved with the DS9 retrospective documentary that's being crowdfunded right now. I think it ends like in 7 days or something, 6 days. I don't know. But, you know, I'm excited to see where that's going to go. And I think it's a good... It seems like Star Trek is kind of having a little bit of a resurgence again with stuff like this. And, you know, it was kind of a dark period for Star Trek for 10 years or so. And it seems like it's coming around again.
I guess one thing that I do want to, we very briefly touched on the Slash segment of this, and I very much was touched and impressed by how seriously they took the concept, right? Like, so many people talk about Slash, oh, it's hilarious, Kirk. So they have, first of all, they have Adam talking about it, and he's amused a bit by it because, let's face it, this is his father that, you know, is dealing with. It does have that, but he's more... impressed by the amount of dedication and love that the fans did it. And then they give the mic over to George Takei, who talks about the importance of Slash to a gay audience. And that's the entirety of who comments on it. And it comes off as very, I don't know. One of the more respectful treatments of Slash fan fiction I've seen in a quote unquote mainstream, thing.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I don't know. That says something. That says about where, number one, where we are societally. We don't think that the concept of somebody writing a fan story about, you know, a romance between two characters who, as they show on, you know, that YouTube clip he mentions, do have a lot of tension. And again, what a portrayal of that tension means to people who, at the time, especially the show was made, were very much underground.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, not to toot our own horn, but I think that you know, even in something like our podcast on the DS9 episode Chimera, for instance, which was obviously, like, you know, Odo and the other changeling, like, wanted to fuck. That is not a reading of that episode that I have.
They linked.
That's right. They did fuck. You're right. I forgot about that. They do have sex. That's not a reading of that episode that I have ever seen before anywhere. So that is a very true thing that George Takei is saying, that you know, queer people will look for the tension, emotional resonance of characters that are perhaps not portrayed as gay on screen, but that could be interpreted that way.
I mean, there's certainly an appreciation for the tongue-in-cheek and the camp of it, which is, you know, which is inherent to Slash, but camp doesn't necessarily make something unserious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Also, I think I kind of hate J.J. Abrams as a person.
Oh, he's awful.
Like, the entire 2009 cast so much slicker than, like, everybody they're interviewing who's older is very human and very down to earth and stuff. And yes, certainly they're older and much more experienced. You know, Walter Koenig has done a lot more interviews than Chris Pine has, simply. But I don't know. There's just a slickness there.
Well, yeah, I have two thoughts on that. Number one, I'm not really sure why J.J. Abrams dresses like a member of the cast of The Sandlot all the time.
Oh, but that's such a good movie.
He wants to dress like a 10-year-old. That's fine. Yeah, I'm not a fan of J.J. Abrams. I don't think he's... this is not a J.J. Abrams podcast, so we'll leave my thoughts on J.J. Abrams as an exercise for the listener. And we'll also talk about that when we get to Star Trek 2009 in about 15 years.
Yeah, I really want to talk about Kolinar, the ritual to purge all emotion, because...
Well, that's from the motion picture. I mean, that's...
But was it specifically to purge the emotion? Okay, because that...
Yeah, it was.
That's so different from my concern. Well... Star Trek 1 had a bad script, but...
I think you're right. But I also... I mean, and Zachary Quinto and his whole thing about, like, oh, well, we're so much more advanced in our storytelling techniques. I'm like, fuck you, whatever. You know, so, yeah, it's a little whatever. But they're not...
Yeah.
You know, it is.
Oh, I know. It's not like... It didn't ruin the movie. It was... It was what it was, but, you know.
And I mean, you know, and to be fair to them as well, I think that... them having to having the desire to put Leonard Nimoy in Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness was a good impulse on them, and speaks to their respect for the original cast and all of those things.
Yeah, so. And it is Star Trek. It is, as you say, part of the family.
Yes.
In a way. They may be the weird cousins by marriage that we don't quite like, but, you know, something, they are part of us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's it for this. As I said again, if you want to watch this documentary, I do recommend it.
Yeah, I liked
it. It's good. Yeah, it's very entertaining. There are a couple of stories that we didn't talk about, even in this podcast, that you'll just have to watch the documentary to find out about. So thank you very much for downloading this. Thank you very much for being our patron. We appreciate each and every one of you very much. Gives us the financial freedom to basically not have to pay for doing this podcast ourselves, which is always great. And has given me the opportunity now to actually use a little bit of my disposable income to give to things like Lambda Legal again.
Yay!
Instead of paying for things like web hosting. So thank you all for that very much. You are
helping to fight Trump.
Yes.
By listening to our podcast, you are part of the resistance.
So thank you for that. next month, we are going to finally do something that has actually been requested by a few people. We are going to talk about what some people, not me, and this is something we'll talk about, call the best Star Trek movie, Galaxy Quest. I do not agree with that.
Okay.
But Galaxy Quest is a fine movie, and we will talk about it next month in April's Patron Special.